Hi, folks. This is Jack Spirko with another edition of the Survival Podcast. As always, one man's view of the changing world, the changing times, and the things we can all do to live a better life if times get tough or even if they don't. Today is Thursday, July the 17th, 2025. And together, folks, we have made it all the way to episode 3706 of the Survival Podcast. And on a Thursday, you know what that means. It is time for an expert counsel Q&A show for the week. I've got some, I guess, or some experts today that we hear from a lot and some that we haven't heard from much in a while. So it should be a fun show. Dr. Paul and Chris Rossini will lead off as usual with the Ron Paul Liberty highlights for the week. This one's very political. It usually is for those guys anyway. But it's, why are there so many total betrayals by Trump right now? And they really are. I haven't heard it yet, so I'll respond with my thoughts after I listen to their segment. But it's, I'll just say right now, at this point, it feels not unexpected, but still quite bizarre. And I'll explain after I hear what they have to say. Nicole Sauce will talk about something far more practical, making and caring for a living culture for your cheese. Yes, it's alive. Doc Bones will talk about dealing with summer heat waves. And we ain't done with them yet. It's mid-July. I will say this. This has been the mildest summer I remember in the state of Texas. The mildest. For the temperature itself. If you looked at our temps, you'd say, that's kind of hot. But for Texas, that's really, for July, really? June? And June was like, what? You know, yeah, we have days in the highs were like 88, 89, 91. You know, it's mid-July now, July 17th. And we're getting highs like 96. Now, I know if you're, like, from the mountains of Tennessee, you're like, that's friggin' hot. I'm going inside till November. In Texas, 96. We get 96 in October. We get 96 in March. I've seen 90s in November or December. There's a difference, though. I'm in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, central Texas. The plains, the Black Prairie Plains. You know what the humidity is supposed to be right now? The humidity is supposed to be right now that if I took, like, a tomato and cut it in half and laid it on the porch in the shade, it would be dehydrated fully in a day or two, without exaggerating. That's how dry the air usually. Usually the grass is brown everywhere right now. Everything's green. And the humidity is more like Houston or southeastern Louisiana than it is like north central Texas this time of year. So it doesn't matter what the temperature on the thermometer is. When you have that kind of humidity in the 90s, it can suck the life right out of you. It's been, the only way I can describe it is nasty this year. So let's hear what Bones has to say about all that. He knows a little about heat living in South Florida, where it's always like it is right now, you know. John Pogliano, I got a question on radios. And I had already looked these radios up. They're called Rapid Radios. I was on driving in a car after dropping the kids off with their mom. This is, for those that are new, not my wife, my daughter-in-law. So we have the grandkids during the week a lot. And Dorothy picks them up, I drop them off. And on the way home, I always listen to AM radio or an audiobook. I'm listening to AM radio, and this commercial comes on for these Rapid Radios, these radios that work all over the country. You pay once a year, and you can talk to anybody in your group with a two-way radio function. And, you know, they really hyped it. And I was like, what is this? I looked it up and went, I don't want that. Why? Well, you'll hear from John. He'll explain it to you. And then he'll use it to explain marketing BS and how what the Rapid Radio people are doing directly correlates to financial product marketing BS. I thought it was an interesting spin. I almost didn't send it to him and just answered the guy by email because I thought, this is too quick of an answer. But I'm glad I sent it to him now because it turned into something pretty cool. Jesse Markowitz will talk about Bitcoin, not mining it, not buying it, but insuring it. What is Bitcoin insurance? Should you insure it? Does it even make any sense? We'll find out from Jesse. Ryan Steva will talk about doing a self-build on a quote-unquote solar generator. All right, I despise the term solar generator, but if you build it yourself, you can call it anything you want. I'll say more about why I hate the term solar generator, the way it's used with, well, you know, referring back to John, BS marketing, right? And then I'm going to talk about something. I thought this was a really interesting question. So I get this question from a guy, and he said, the crit method that you talked about sounds a lot like building a custom AI agent. I'm going to call that a custom GPT because I use mostly ChatGPT, at least for now. I'm beginning to evaluate some other platforms like Gemini, and I have reasons, which I'm not going to divulge today. But GPT works, and for some things it works really, really good, but I feel that I want to learn as much as I can about as many of the platforms as possible so that I can always be using the one that's best for me at any given time as my go-to. But a custom agent sounds like you have to program and stuff like that. I don't know, and I'm going to talk about it from the GPT side because I haven't played with Gemini or any of these others enough yet to know exactly how to do it. I know how to do it with GPT. But the CRIT method is context, role, interview, task. And a custom GPT is a lot like that because you give context and role. And you can do interview and task anytime you want to after that, and that's just sitting there pre-programmed. And I've done this, for instance, one of the custom GPTs I created is a chef, a very specific kind of chef that is specifically designed to help me with mushroom recipes for things I'm working on for the fall workshop that I and Ken Daniels are working on for the fall workshop, which is going to be more like appetizers, like a amuse-bouche type stuff. And it's pretty cool. I've learned a lot by playing with it. It's like play with something that actually has a positive output but also teaches you. Educational toys for adults. That's what AI is becoming for me. But the CRIT method and the custom agent are really very similar. And the answer is you'll have to wait till I get to my segment. Before we do that, let me just remind you guys that you can always help us out by doing your online shopping where? tspaz.com. That's right, T-S-P-A-Z, tspaz.com. You can't forget it. Who the hell could forget something like T-Spaz? I'm glad it wasn't around when I was in school, like in grade school or high school. I probably would have been called a T-Spaz and not even know what it means and still been mad. But I got something for you today. This is not really a product review. It's more like a deal of the day thing that popped up. And I've had this thing around a lot in the last few months. It's gone on sale a bunch of times down in like the $130, $138 range. This is for you DeWalt guys. If you're not a DeWalt guy and you don't already have DeWalt batteries and chargers, you can skip ahead 35 seconds. The DeWalt cordless jigsaw, bare tool, is on sale today. Like I said, it's been $136, $137, $138 a few times recently. It's on sale for freaking $99 today. Now, this is a bare tool. So if you don't already have the DeWalt platform, it's probably not for you. But I'm telling you, the jigsaw is almost inevitably, other than maybe an angle grinder, the last cordless hand tool people buy for their setup. And you don't think you need one until you have one. And once you have one, you're like, oh God, why did I wait so long to get this? There's so much flexibility with a hand cordless jigsaw. And $99, this is a $200 tool. $206 or so. It's 53% off, I think. Let me look at my own write-up here. But it's a deep discount. I guess I didn't put down the discount. It's like 52 or 53% off. And so if you have the DeWalt platform and you don't have a jigsaw, I would get this. I can't even tell. I'm going to click on it right now. I mean, as I'm recording to see if it's still on sale. It is, $99. DeWalt, when they do these ridiculously low prices, it's almost always throttled. And what I mean by that is what they do is they decide we want to sell X number of these things at this price. Usually it's like an inventory clear out or something like that. And once they hit it, they raise the price. In fact, usually they stair-step raise. In fact, they usually stair-step drop. So this actually was $91 this morning when I got out of bed and I looked at my price alerts. And by the time I got around to putting it up, it went from $91 to $99. So what they tend to do is, as they hit certain marks, they raise the price. And then when they hit a certain point, they put it back. So if you want one of these, I would jump on it. And this is an impetus. If you were on the Telegram group or channel, you would have known about this 2 hours before I'm recording this, and probably another 2 hours before it goes live. So 4 hours head start. So Daily Mail's great, all my social media is great, but you have no guarantee if you're on like X or Facebook when I drop this stuff if you're going to see it, because algorithm. If you are on Telegram and you don't silence it, you'll know, and you're only going to hear from me 3 or 4 times a day One quick little text message. That's all it's going to be. You can just ignore the ones you're not interested in. But every once in a while, something like this comes up, like, you know, the plasma cutter that I put out like a year ago for $99, and it was like a $280 plasma cutter because they screwed up, and we cleaned out the inventory in like an hour and a half, and by the time it got on the air, it was already gone, and thank God I've learned from my own mistakes, and I bought one before I told anybody. Yeah, I think I sold like 64 of those before whoever was selling them realized they screwed the price up, because that price was not supposed to be that low. So get on the Telegram group or channel. With that, let's drop in and hear from Dr. Paul and Chris Rossini on betrayals by the Orange Man. And I know some of you guys really like Trump, some of you guys really hate Trump, but I think in this situation that we're in right now, betrayal is the right word.
What kind of a week did the president have? Did he have a good week? You know, he's given some pretty good talks, you know, even on foreign policy. I'm here to stop wars. I'm not here to start wars. I'm here to end war. And that kind of talk was always good. But then I have to every once in a while, even back then, remember, yeah, George W. Bush said a lot of those similar things too, but we were just getting ready to accelerate on wars. So right now, you know, there are several things that we want to talk about.
Yes, President Trump, I would say out of both of his administrations, this had to be perhaps the worst week, where he just pounded away on his supporters to where they can't even take it anymore. And we're going to talk about the other issues, but yes, the Epstein is obviously the biggest one, first because of the moral implications. I mean, just from a moral standpoint, this is just horrible for our nation that our government is doing this with heinous crimes, you know, letting criminals off the hook, and not, you know, shoplifters as bad as shoplifting is, terrible crimes. And this has upset even his most loyal supporters. You could see it on X all day, every day. It's not going away. And I'm sure on the other side, too, people on all sides are upset because everybody knows that this is not true. Files were on Bondi's desk, all these disgusting videos that they were watching. And then all of a sudden, case closed, no clients, no blackmail. And then Trump made it even worse when he said, "You're still talking about this," when he was just simply asked the question. So it's, you know, from a moral standpoint, it is terrible for our nation, for the world sees what our nation is doing with this, not only because of the crimes itself, but also the other aspect of it, and you and Daniel covered it this week, is that these crimes were used for blackmail. So that means that these that our leaders, perhaps, are being blackmailed. They're not actually our representatives. They're representing someone else that's blackmailing them. I mean, this is very bad, and I know they probably want this to go away, but I think the American people, this was a big one, and I don't think it's going to be accepted.
But well, I wanted to mention this about Ukraine. There's been a lot of talk about Ukraine, and they were going to stop that war at once. But Daniel and I, as well as Chris, we, over these years, we have tried to point out that this whole thing about who started what, they failed to recognize that we participated in a coup. The record is there. The evidence is there. And we were the ones that broke our promises about staying away from the borders of Russia. And Russia's history indicates, well, maybe they have a reason to be nervous about what the West is doing.
The Ukraine war is another major, I'm not even going to say mistake. This is not a mistake. He's consciously continuing this war. And our country, you know, people can see the bankruptcy around us. And by far, the number one reason is the military-industrial complex and the warfare state, the empire. So everybody knows this. We don't want this anymore. We want to keep our money here and try to live normal lives. And President Trump campaigned on this. And this war in Ukraine was lost before it even began. kind of like the Middle East. You're not going to go in there, oh, we're going to go in, bring freedom and democracy, and everybody's going to have a McDonald's, and everybody will be just like America. We were saying before it even started, no, you're not. You're not going to do any of this. And 20 years and trillions of dollars later, they didn't, because it's impossible. So Ukraine defeating Russia was as close to impossible as you can get to. Yet they did it anyway. And President Trump, all he had to do was go in and say, that's it. Biden's failed war is Biden's failed war. I'm washing my hands of this. I want no part of it. And that's it for America. It is now 6 months later. He has done no such thing. He says now they need more weapons, and just has gone back on it. So he is making Biden's failed war, which was a failure at the beginning, his own failed war on top of it. So shame, very, very shameful, because it's continuing the bankruptcy of our country. The military empire is our big albatross, and President Trump is just continuing it.
Yeah, I mean, I'll go with big three so far. Big three so far. Israel, and just propping up a regime that has completely decimated an entire micronation of Gaza. What's going on there is disgusting. And what's going on right now with them bombing to their north is also disgusting. Completely blowing up civilian buildings. I mean, leveling civilian buildings to the ground. And then Trump turns around and goes, I can't believe what Putin did in a war, when there's collateral damage. I mean, collateral damage is terrible. But Putin's not targeting apartment complexes or orphanages, as is being said. It's ridiculous. If Putin was doing half the shit they say he was doing, there'd no longer be a war in Ukraine, because there wouldn't be shit left of it at this point. So those two are just absolute betrayals of being the president that would bring peace. Neither of them actually surprised me, though. I have to say that enabling the extension of Ukraine actually surprises me a little bit. Israel is exactly what I expected. Expected doesn't mean wanted for special children. The Epstein thing. The betrayal, don't get so upset when I say what I'm about to say. The betrayal in of itself really isn't the failure to release the files. There will be no files released. There are no files coming. There were never going to be any files coming. I put up a meme in February with the kid from The Matrix with the bending spoon saying, you have to understand there are no files. Okay? You're never going to see any files. There will never be any files. There's no list. There's no clients list. It doesn't exist. You're not getting it. It wasn't at the FBI building in New York. And if there is a list, it's in Israel in the hands of Mossad. Okay? That's where it is. So it's not going to happen. The betrayal is the way that he has handled it and himself since they said the truth, you're not getting the files. You're not getting the client list. The way he has talked about his own supporters basically being idiots, and only an idiot would care about this. There was a recent poll. It's something like 87% of people in the country want these files released. 87%. And that's like across party, that's across just across the whole spectrum. 87% say, hey, let the chips fall. Well, it could be important. Yeah, I don't care. Straight to the wood chipper you go. This is crimes against children. There is no more reprehensible thing. But I don't think that there's the ability to give you what you're asking for here. But to talk to people like they're pieces of shit for wanting it. And I will say this for Trump. I actually, if I'm wrong, send me a clip. I don't remember him promising this. I don't. I don't remember him saying, when I get elected, I'm going to release the Epstein client list. Not once. I think a lot of people feel like he did. I think it's a lot like people think that Ed McMahon worked for Publishers Clearinghouse when he actually worked for some other thing. You know, the Mandela effect. Here's who did it. All the surrogates did it. The people that now are in a position to do it did it. Bondi did it. Bondi said it would happen. Cash Patel said it would happen. Bongino didn't promise anything because he didn't know he was going to be part of anything, but he stated it needed to be done, it needed to be done, it needed to be done, and all of a sudden he's a deputy director of the FBI, and he ain't doing it either. So I don't know that you can really say, well, Trump said he would do it. Now, again, if you could show me a clip, I'll be the first person to say I'm wrong. And I really thought he did. And then I started thinking, well, when? Anytime I listened to a Trump speech or whatever, did I ever actually hear him say even the word Epstein? No, I didn't. Now, there are people that say it's because he's in the files, he's on a list. And like I keep trying to tell you people, in the files and on a list are different things. If my neighbor gets murdered or even assaulted really badly and ends up in a hospital, the police are going to interview me. I'm in the files. Every known associate of Epstein was interviewed. They're in the files. His pool boy is in the files. His private chef is in the files. The guy to cut his fucking grass is in the files. The files in a list, and they're using these words to fuck with you. The files in a list, they're using them interchangeably. They are not the same thing. A client list is not the files. The files is everything. The client list would be, these are people that either we know or believe to have participated in child trafficking as recipients from Jeffrey Epstein. This is what I find interesting. I have heard, and I have what I would call 95% confirmation. I will not report this as 100% confirmed, that Maxwell has stated she is absolutely willing to come in front of Congress and testify as to what actually happened. Who, what, where, when, and why. And supposedly all the Congress is like, well, we don't object to that, but yet no subpoenas. Huh. Interesting. I don't know who is in the list, but I know there is a list. I just know you're not getting it. But the betrayal to me from Arjvan is to talk to the people who literally got this man elected like they're dirt for expecting that the things that they were promised by the people that popped him up are not coming because they still want him. That is the biggest betrayal, and it is a bizarre betrayal. And the reason it's a bizarre betrayal is they can easily spin Israel and Ukraine, and they can get away with it. I'm not saying they should. I'm saying they can. This Epstein thing, and the way he has treated people over it, is one of the most weird, dumb blind spots in political history. It has the potential to destroy his legacy. That has a lot of bad, but a lot of good in it. To absolutely rip asunder his legacy. And here's the thing. If anybody ever comes up with any sort of a convincing narrative now, that he, in fact, is on the client list. I know there's people that will believe it no matter what, and I know there's people that won't believe it at all. But the people that you can be moved, they now have a much bigger reason to believe that he is than he's not. And he's done it to himself. And it is incredibly bizarre of a thing for a politician to do. How could he have handled it? Let's say I was advising him. Well, I'd advise him, like, let the chips fall. If there, you know, you need to be clear and concise and tell the truth, whatever that is. But it's not Biden made it up. Biden and Obama made it up. No. This shit goes back to when Bush was a president, and it was going on for 4 years when Trump was president, or Trump was president the first time. This is not new by any stretch of the words. If he was going to handle it though and not release it, the smart thing would have been to say, I've hired very good people. They're doing their job. This is what we can do right now, and we can't do anything else. And shut up. But Trump, his biggest weakness is he can't shut his orange mouth. He cannot shut his orange mouth. Somebody needs to take away that man's phone at close of business and not give it back to him till the morning, because the ranting nonsense the guy posts in the middle of the night, talking shit about the people that really he owes big time, it's unbelievable. It's unbelievable. Anyway, let's go on to better things, like making cheese.
Well, hello, folks. This is Nicole Soss from the Living Free in Tennessee podcast and Holler Roast Coffee with an expert segment all about one of life's most important topics, and that topic is cheese. Over the weekend, I gave a cheese class to show people how to make the first cheeses you should learn how to make, which are soft cheeses like farmer's cheese, Chev, cream cheese, mozzarella, that sort of thing. We decided to do a Chev for this one because I had access to fantastic fresh raw goat's milk at the place where we were doing the cheese demonstration. And I've been making cheese for over a decade now, which is one of my personal hobby passions that has not turned into a business other than doing the webinar that you can buy at Living Free in Tennessee or demonstrations like the one I did this weekend. Otherwise, the only benefit, only in air quotes, is that we have cheese made from scratch at my house, which is delicious, and I think it's healthier because I haven't had to package it for commercial shipping with extra things in it to help deter it from going bad. And here's the funny thing about cheese, right? Cheese is a way to preserve milk to begin with. So it has the preservative built in, and that is the lactobacillus bacteria that are in there. So why am I talking to you about cheese today? Here's the deal. If you really get into making cheese, things can start adding up from a budgetary standpoint. You need to buy the cheese culture. You need to get your rennet. You need to purchase lipase sometimes. There's all, and you can buy all sorts of ancillary materials like a cheese press and all these other things. Well, one of the things I like to do in my initial class is talk to people about how to save money. And there's five tips that I can give you on not breaking the bank when you decide to start getting into cheese making. But today I just want to focus on one. And this is your mesophilic culture. So when you start making these softer cheeses, usually you're using a mesophilic culture, which is a culture that works at lower temperatures. We're talking below 90 to 100 degrees. So your mesophilic culture, when you order it from somewhere like cheesemaking.com or Amazon has them, or you get it from another cheesemaker, comes in a little packet and it's powdered. It's kind of like instant yeast or quick yeast that you get for making bread that's powdered. And so you need to reconstitute that in your milk. And so many recipes start with bring the milk to XYZ temperature, throw the culture in, let it do its job for a while. And the job it's doing is it is eating the sugars in the milk and acidifying it, which will curdle the milk, causing the solids to separate from the liquids. And then we strain out those solids in a variety of different ways to make cheese. Get it? Got it good? Okay. So here's the deal. You cannot very easily buy these powdered cultures in bulk. So I can get an entire quart of rennet, which is something I go through a lot because I make a lot of cheese. But getting the equivalent, like the volume of an 8-ounce cup of mesophilic powdered culture doesn't happen. And some of my recipes call for like a full quarter teaspoon of that. So we like to do critical thinking here at the Survival Podcast. And I started asking myself, self, how did people get cheese culture before they could order it on Amazon? And that, of course, led me down a bit of a rabbit trail, and I learned something pretty cool that can save you money if you're making cheese, and that is this. You can keep your cheese culture alive just like you do a sourdough starter. Now, I've been homesteading for 18 years. You would think that that would have just been naturally apparent to me, and it should have been, but sometimes the things that are most obvious to us do not occur to us until way later in the game. So today I want to tell you how you keep and or develop and maintain a cheese culture if you want a specific mesophilic culture from powder. And it's in this way. You get your culture from wherever you're going to get it. A friend, Amazon, cheesemaking.com, New England Cheese Company, whoever has the culture you want. And you culture about a quarter teaspoon of the powder into 8 ounces of milk. Your milk needs to either be raw or pasteurized. Do not do this with the ultra pasteurized milk. And then you put it on your counter and you let it sit there. And if you know how things work when you're brewing beer or anything else, because it's not super cold, the bacteria wake up and they say, gosh, I'm hungry. And they're like, sweet, there's milk sugars all around me, I can eat this. And then they multiply. So you leave it on your counter for a day or two, and you'll know that it's been successful because you'll start seeing that the solids are, in fact, separating from the liquids. And when that has happened, then you know you have a live culture. And you can either leave it at room temperature and keep feeding it milk and using it and feeding it milk, or you can slow down the party and put it in your refrigerator. Now, they, on the internet, say that you should once a week, just like with your sourdough starter, if you do sourdough starter, take some out and put the fresh milk in so that your cheese culture can have more food and stay happy, healthy, and strong. And they are correct, except if you don't do this, if you do what I do and you put it in your fridge and forget it's there for 3 weeks, guess what? It's probably still alive, and you can take it back out, add milk, and then observe to see if it is moving forward. Now, one of my favorite tests on a culture to make sure we haven't done something horrible like facilitate the wrong bacteria is to give it the sniff test. So it's going to smell kind of soury, cheesy. It is not going to smell more deep poopy diapery. So if you're going more deep pooper diapery bad milk smell, that's not good. If it's more of a sour, bright, yogurty smell, that's, or sour cream or that sort of smell, then you know it's going in the right direction. So what I've come to on this, and I wanted to wait for this segment till it actually made cheese from it, is that you can spend money one time, get that powdered culture, start it in the milk, nurture it like a sourdough starter, add milk about once a week, and keep it going, and then use it in your cheese. And the ratio is 2 tablespoons of culture. The official ratio is 2 tablespoons of culture per quarter teaspoon in a recipe, or about 2 tablespoons per gallon in your cheese recipe. The deal is this, though. Most cheese recipes work on strict timelines and temperatures, and that is because when you know the milk is at 85 degrees, for example, you know the bacteria are acting at a certain speed, and then you can say, so let it culture for 45 minutes. If you're moving into using a live culture, you may need to learn through observation where your cheese is as far as has it cultured well enough. And the way you're going to know that is by visually inspecting it, because when you acidify milk, it can cause the solids to separate from the liquids. And it the scent changes as it becomes more acidic. When I did it, I actually decided the following thing. It's really hard to go wrong if you add too much culture. So I've been doing a quarter to a half cup of culture into per gallon of milk to make the cheese, knowing that if for some reason they're having a slow day, that they will probably keep with the timeline of my recipe. So for Chev, for example, I'll do a gallon of goat's milk, quarter to half cup of the culture thrown in, and let it sit. So you bring the milk up to 80 degrees, throw the culture in gently. Throw is probably not the best word. Stir it gently but thoroughly. Then you add a drop of double strength rennet, and then you stir that gently, and then you let it sit for 12 hours. So I like to start it at night and go overnight. And the way you know you're successful in the morning is it's kind of like if you tilt the pot that you're aging it in a little bit, you'll have sort of this solid yogurty looking mass, and then the liquid that is the whey on the outside. And then you pour that through a strainer, you hang it in a cloth for until it's the right consistency, which is in my case usually about 2 hours, but most recipes say 4 to 6 hours. And then you add salt to taste, and if you like to have your Chev cheese with blueberry in it or rosemary and garlic or whatever, you can do that at that time. That stores in your fridge for about 2 weeks. If you want to freeze it, don't spice it. That stores in your freezer for up to 6 months, and then you can just defrost it and add whatever flavors you want. But the cool thing is, after having used my live culture compared to what it, like the taste compared to the dry culture is much nicer. So what's happened, and I don't know why, I'm sure I'll figure out why, is that using that live culture also has mellowed out the flavor of the cheese. So I think keeping the bacteria alive must make them feel happier and healthier over time, and maybe they're just acclimating to their environment. But the Chev I made with that culture was amazing. So that's a way you can save money, right? You can save money in a couple of ways. One, you're making cheese and you don't have to buy it from somebody. And it's higher quality than probably anything you can get at the store. So remember, when we're saving money, in air quotes, by making our own stuff from scratch, we are comparing it to the highest end thing you can get, not the lowest end entry level commercialized mass produced potentially dead grocery store alternative. And you're not needing to buy culture at $16 to $20 a pop, which means that you can keep more of your money in your pocket and end up with a higher quality product. And when you are keeping living things like this going in your kitchen, that releases beneficial bacteria into the air around you, and that's really awesome too. So if you've gotten into cheese making and not asked yourself that question, how do I keep my culture alive? Now you know. We'll do a second segment about this, on how to keep, how to capture in the wild a culture and go from there. If you are interested in finding out more about what we're doing here in the holler, you can follow me at livingfreeintennessee.com. And it is summer and it is hot and my air conditioner broke. That's right. Why do you care about that? Because the air conditioner that broke is in my roasting shack. And I have launched a coffee pre-buy over at hollerroast.com, where you can buy basically a gift card, which you can use immediately. And if you buy this gift card at certain levels, you get extra digital perks. You can check that out at hollerroast.com. I am pre-selling coffee to offset the expense of installing, unexpectedly, an air conditioner unit. So we call it the HVAC pre-buy project. Check that out. You can have delicious coffee and help me not roast in a sauna over at hollerroast.com. Make it a great week, guys.
Great. We made cheese. We put the cheese in a cool place so it doesn't melt. But what about when you have to go to a place where you might melt? Yep, heat waves are here. It is the summer. Doc Bones will tell us how to deal with it.
Hi, Joe Alton, MD here, also known as Dr. Bones of the survival website doomandbloom.net, co-author of the Book Excellence Award-winning fourth edition of the Survival Medicine Handbook, and designer of quality medical kits at store.doomandbloom.net. Summer has just arrived, but it's coming in hot, and with the formation of a large heat dome bringing some of the hottest weather so far this year to large parts of the U.S. More than 30 cities are expected to break century-old records for high temperatures before the end of next week. 200 million people from Colorado to Maine will be affected at one point or another. Many consider a heat wave to be just the time to put some extra ice cubes in the lemonade, but it's really a deadly natural disaster. More people die in heat waves in the U.S. than just about any recent weather event short of Hurricane Katrina. The U.S. certainly has its share, but heat waves causing large numbers of deaths are actually pretty common throughout the world. In 2015, thousands died in a major heat wave in India and Pakistan. Tens of thousands died in a European heat wave in 2003. This week's heat dome is caused by hot air unable to escape due to high pressure systems over much of the central part of the country. These systems can sometimes stretch for more than 1,000 miles. A heat dome acts like a lid on a pot, causing compressed air to sink and temperatures to soar. Storms may form at the edges, possibly leading to tornadoes in some areas. Making matters worse, the heat index will make it feel even hotter. The heat index is calculated from the temperature combined with the humidity, much like wind chill is a combination of air temperature and wind speed. High humidity limits the ability of the body to sweat, which is one of the ways that humans get rid of excess heat. It's expected that due to the high humidity giving little relief at night, that some residents are going to feel as if the temperature is up to 20 degrees higher than the actual air temperature. Where is this humidity coming from? It could be coming from, of all things, cornfields. The huge amount of land dedicated to growing corn in the Midwest increases air humidity. This is because corn sweats, much like a human does in the hot weather. The effect is to keep the humidity, and thus the heat index, high. Rural areas won't be the only areas affected, however. Urban areas will also feel the heat. Paved roads and concrete buildings form what we call a heat island, as they absorb more heat during the day and cool down slower at night. This causes nighttime temperatures to stay high in large cities. You might think that the most danger will be in areas like South Florida, which has a subtropical climate year-round. But citizens of Miami are accustomed to heat, and less heat-related deaths occur there than would in parts of the country that normally have milder weather. Residents of North Dakota, for example, have less experience with extreme heat, and some buildings may not have air conditioners. This puts them at more risk for heat-related emergencies like heat exhaustion and heat stroke. Older individuals that might have limited ability to seek help, well, they are especially at risk. The ill effects due to overheating are called heat exhaustion if they're mild or moderate, and if severe, these effects are referred to as heat stroke. Heat exhaustion usually does not result in permanent damage if you treat it, but heat stroke can. Indeed, it can permanently disable or even kill its victim. It's a medical emergency that must be diagnosed and treated promptly. Simply having muscle cramps or a fainting spell does not necessarily signify a major heat-related medical event. You'll see heat cramps oftentimes in children who are running around on a hot day. Getting them out of the sun, massaging the affected muscles, and providing hydration, that usually resolves the problem. In addition to muscle cramps or fainting, heat exhaustion is characterized by confusion, rapid pulse, flushing, sweating, sometimes excessive, nausea and vomiting, headache, and a temperature elevation of up to 105 degrees Fahrenheit. If no action is taken to cool the victim, heat stroke may ensue. Heat stroke, in addition to all the possible signs and symptoms I just mentioned of heat exhaustion, can manifest as a loss of consciousness, could manifest as seizures, or even bleeding into urine or vomit. Breathing becomes rapid and shallow. If not dealt with quickly, shock and organ malfunction may ensue, possibly leading to death. In heat stroke, the skin is hot to the touch, but could be dry. Sweating might be absent. The body makes efforts to cool itself down until it hits a temperature of about 105 degrees. At that point, thermoregulation breaks down and the body's ability to use sweating as a natural temperature regulator fails. In heat stroke, the body core can rise to 110 degrees Fahrenheit or more. In some circumstances, the patient's skin may actually seem cool. It's important to realize that it is the body core temperature that's elevated. A person in shock may feel cold and clammy to you, but you could be misled by this finding. Taking a reading with a thermometer will reveal the patient's true status. When overheated patients are no longer able to cool themselves, it's up to their rescuers to do the job. If a heat-related emergency is suspected, the victim should immediately be removed from the heat source, for example, get them out of the sun, have their clothing removed, be drenched with cool water or ice if available, have their legs elevated above the level of their heart, that's called the shock position, be fanned or otherwise ventilated to help with heat evaporation, and have moist, cold compresses placed in the neck, armpit, and groin areas. Now you might ask, why the neck, armpit, and groin? Major blood vessels pass close to the skin in these areas, and cold packs will more effectively cool the body core. Now, some recent studies conducted by the military also suggest cooling the hands and feet may help. Oral hydration is useful to replace fluids lost, but only if the patient is awake and alert. If your patient has altered mental status, he or she may swallow the fluid into their airways. This causes damage to the lungs and puts you in worse shape than when you started. Heat stroke is actually preventable in many cases. The Arizona State Department of Health, they should know, recommends the following. You should drink at least 2 liters, about half a gallon of water a day if you're mostly indoors, and 1 to 2 additional liters for every hour of outdoor time. Drink before you feel thirsty and avoid alcohol and caffeine. You should wear lightweight, light-colored clothing and will use a sun hat or umbrella to deflect the sun's rays. Eat smaller, frequent meals rather than large ones. Avoid strenuous activity. Stay indoors as much as possible during the heat of the day. Take regular breaks if you must exert yourself on warm days. In a heat wave, it's important to check on the elderly, the very young, and the infirm regularly and often. These people may have more difficulty seeking help, and you might just save a life if you're vigilant. This is Joe Alton, MD, that old Dr. Bones, wishing you the best of health in good times or bad. Thanks for listening. Hey, learn more about more than 200 off-grid medical topics in the award-winning 4th edition of the Survival Medicine Handbook, and get your family medically prepared with quality kits and individual supplies from our entire line at store.doomandbloom.net. You'll be glad you did.
Good stuff, as always, from Doc, and stuff that can help keep you either out of the ER or even keep you alive. Heat is no joke. The one thing that I do just hits me in the craw out of that segment is he used the bullshit marketing term, heat dome. I am so sick of the Weather Channel. I am so sick of all the weather people. I am so sick of the compulsive need they have to put dark red on every map they make about anything. They've gone to nothing but being internet shill whores at this point, really. And the others haven't even pointed out, we're about to talk about marketing bullshit with John Pugliano and something called Rapid Radios.
Hello, TSP. Well, today we have a really excellent question from Jerry. And he's specifically asking about Rapid Radios. And I'm going to use his question to transition into how to be aware of marketing bullshit and specifically how it relates to the financial industry. Hey, speaking of all that, I'm really excited to see you guys down at Jack's Fall Workshop. And I'm actually going to be talking on a topic very similar to this segment. My presentation is going to be entitled, How to Read the News. And what I'll be doing is sharing with you how I go through and read the headlines and read the news, what I use as a bullshit indicator, and how I translate that specifically in my case into, you know, making money in the stock market. Hey, but in any case, back to Jerry's question. Jerry is asking about Rapid Radios. You've probably seen their advertisements. Their big claim to fame is that they can provide nationwide communication, specifically in an emergency when the cell phones go down, and they do it all for no monthly fee. Jerry is, you know, seeing some of the bullshit in all this, and he says, I'm assuming this has to work on cell phone networks, but that makes me wonder how it cannot have a fee to use. Well, Jerry, if you listen carefully to their advertising, they're not saying they don't have any fee. They're saying they don't have a monthly fee. They do charge an annual fee. Now, that annual fee initially is built into the price of buying the device, but to use it after that anniversary date, you have to pay an annual fee. So clearly, you've caught them in a lie. And you have to ask yourself, if they're going to lie about something that basic, what else are they lying about? Right? And that's how your BS meter should go up. When someone's promising you something that doesn't make sense, that's where you should really start digging in deeper, and particularly in the things you don't understand. And in your case, you're smart enough to say, well, hey, they got to be operating on some kind of a cell phone network, right? Because they specifically tell you that they work with all carriers. And so if one goes down, they can still use the other system. But here's the deal. In most emergency situations where the, quote, cell phones are down, the reason they're down is probably because some kind of a natural disaster, right? Like a hurricane comes through and knocks over all the cell phone towers. So it doesn't matter if you can use T-Mobile and Verizon and AT&T's networks, because the cell phone tower that all those networks use is down. And if it's a bad enough and prolonged enough type of disaster where it's knocked out all the grid electricity, then those cell phone towers, which are powered by electricity, are not going to function. No, they do have backup batteries, but they are batteries, right? And they only last so long. And even if they are recharged to some degree by solar power, well, right, that's not going to work once the sun goes down. Now, again, specific to Rapid Radios, really what they're using is just a modern version of the old Nextel push-to-talk over cellular technology. You remember Nextel? Yeah, that distinctive chirp. For all intents and purposes, it's the same technology, and in some cases, where it may be more resilient than cell phones, listen, if the disaster's bad enough, none of that stuff's going to work. Okay, so here's the bottom line in all this. What you're seeing in this marketing is the same type of marketing you're getting all over the place, specifically in the financial industry. That's why Jack calls people in the industry financial liars. They're going to do the same thing, like specifically with fees. Note how I pointed out that Rapid Radio markets to you that there's no monthly fee, trying to create an illusion like a magician would by getting you to look at the fact that there's zero monthly fee, right? That doesn't mean there's not an annual fee. So likewise, when you hear someone in the financial industry tell you there's no management fee, then you should probably look for transaction fees. And if they tell you there's no transaction fees, then you probably should be looking for management fees. Or if they tell you there's just no fees at all, and you don't see management fees or transaction fees, then dig deeper, because there's probably some type of capital restrictions where you're limited, or in some cases, totally prohibited from withdrawing your money out at all. In which case, it doesn't matter if there's no fees if you can't get your money back. Or there may be other things that aren't called fees, but they're actually penalties, like early redemption. And if you hear someone in the financial industry telling you your principal is guaranteed, then dig a little deeper because it also most likely means that your earnings are also capped. Okay, bottom line on this is if something sounds too good to be true, it is, right? People in business, regardless of what type of product or service they're selling, they're not doing it out of altruism. They're doing it to make a profit. And so if they're trying to hide the fact that somehow you're being charged a fee for something, then your bullshit detection meter should start going up. And you should either start digging deeper in to find out where they're lying or, again, just cut the transaction off altogether. Because you don't want to deal with people like that. Hey, but in any case, just my opinion. If you'd like to learn more about me and my opinions on investing in the stock market, then please check out Investable Wealth and the Wealth Studying Podcast.
So is there even a use for them, these rapid radios? I can give you one. And it is the kind of thing that I can see working for like construction crews and stuff like that. So it is no doubt the case that there is a propensity by people when they're supposed to be working to do a lot of bullshit and waste with their phones. But if you tell, let's say, a work crew, well, when you come into the office, leave your cell phones here at the office, and that way we know you're working instead of using your cell phone. They'll come up with a million excuses that all involve, you know the word, emergencies, like checking their Facebook and dicking around and making videos and, I don't know, taking pictures of their junk and sexting their girlfriend or whatever it is that they're actually doing with them. So we actually gave all of our employees, back when I was in the underground construction market, Nextels. That tells you how long ago this was. They all had Nextel radios with the cell phone feature disabled. So basically this product. And our rule was no cell phones on a job site. And everybody had to come to the office, and then they were dispatched to whichever site they were on. Because we were running like 12 crews. Now, this applied to our in-house crews, not our subcontractors. We just took 20% from those guys, and they did their own thing. We gave them jobs and basically stayed hands-off. Just kind of oversight and make sure that their footage was right and all. But all of the direct employees would have to leave their phones at the office, and then they could pick them up when they went home. Emergencies! If you have an emergency, you have a radio. Call Charlene. She was like our dispatch ops manager type girl. And you explain your emergency, and she'll help you out. If someone calls you with an emergency, they just need to know that they're not going to be able to call you between this hour and this hour. And they can call Charlene. And she will immediately get in touch with you with the emergency and let you know what to do. They didn't like this, but you know what? I didn't give a shit. And I'm going to tell you, we're going back into the late 90s here. Most of them didn't have phones anyway of their own. They were all angry that the phone we gave them wasn't really a phone. Didn't care. They were allowed to take the radios home. That way we could get in touch with them and they can get in touch with us. Primarily in case occasionally we would redirect somebody to a job site instead of coming to the office. But mostly so they could let us know if there was a problem and they were going to be late. But this actually works really well. And let me tell you something. There was a lot less effing off on cell phones in, you know, this time frame than there was than there is today. There were no apps. You weren't watching YouTube videos. All you could do is make phone calls and text, basically. And phones did take pictures. So you could text pictures. That was it. It was all, and it was still a problem, and it's still why we went to that system. So I'm not saying there's no use for these. I'm saying the marketed use is really not very valuable, but it's a cost-effective way to run crews and to be able to broadcast messages because you can talk to groups, and it's useful. Now, an app called Zello does all that, but then they still have their phones. So that's about the only legitimate use for these that I can see. They're definitely not a good emergency product. But they would be a good crew management product in the right use with the right procedure. My lesson for our AI group today was that you have to look at AI and employees both like tools. And I don't mean that to be insulting to the employees. It's just that you can give two managers the same three employees, and one manager will kill it with them, and one manager will claim they're not good enough. It's how you manage them. So you have to manage tools and people at an operator level to be successful in business. And so this could be done that way. That's all I can come up with. Moving on, let's talk about Bitcoin insurance with Jesse Markowitz.
Hi, this is Jesse Markowitz with yourpersonalbitcoinassistant.com. Today I have a question from someone who asks about Bitcoin insurance. William asks, so I've heard that there are now Bitcoin insurance products. Do I need this? Can you give me examples of what this insurance might be? Before we get started on Bitcoin insurance, let me just say this is an advanced topic for most people. If you haven't yet started with Bitcoin, don't worry about this. Just get started. Jack did episode 3704 on Tuesday this week on building Bitcoin wealth. That's a great place to start. With that out of the way, let's talk Bitcoin insurance. There are two separate areas here. First, insuring your Bitcoin, an insurance policy to protect your Bitcoin in case of theft of keys, destruction of keys, and fires and floods. And secondly, insurance denominated in Bitcoin. Since most risks covered by insurance are fiat-focused, almost all policies are too. I have found one exception, a life insurance policy where you pay in Bitcoin, and the payout is in Bitcoin as well. So, first type first, insuring your Bitcoin. This is not a product for most of us. It's generally expensive, and while it may cover loss of keys due to natural disasters and fires, as well as theft of keys, including physical coercion, often referred to as the $5 wrench attack, it won't cover the most likely risk that most people have, which is losing your hardware device and or seed phrase. In addition, in order to be covered, you normally need to have your Bitcoin either fully custodied by them or in a multi-key joint vault that they manage. So who is this for? Primarily companies who want to protect against risk of their custodians, either internal employees or outside companies, losing their Bitcoin via theft, fraud, accident, or external hack. A company starting a Bitcoin treasury strategy might want and be willing to pay a premium to protect itself. An exchange may want this as an addition to cybercrime insurance, so if they're hacked or robbed, the insurance could cover some of that loss. Individuals might want this just like they have homeowners or renters insurance that covers the property of their house and other valuables and possessions. They might want something like this in that same category. But like cash, art, firearms, and collectibles, the amount your basic insurance covers will be minimal, if it's covered at all, unless you get a specific rider for that property. Riders like this are very expensive generally, if they're available at all. For Bitcoin, I have not seen one yet that covers it. One interesting take on this is offered by a company called AnchorWatch, anchorwatch.com. They built a proprietary vault software specifically to allow cold storage of Bitcoin across multiple signing devices where you as the customer and AnchorWatch hold keys. Because it's their software and they have a key, it helps them monitor and protect your Bitcoin in ways they can't if you just had it on a hardware wallet at home. In particular, while your Bitcoin is insured with them, spending that Bitcoin requires multiple signatures, including at least one from AnchorWatch. This is what allows them to help protect you against theft. Someone stealing your keys, it's not enough to move the funds. Now, designed in with this, they have a time-locked recovery path, so if they're unavailable or after the insurance ends, customers can regain unilateral access to their Bitcoin. They typically do not do small customers. You need at least $250,000 and up to about $100 million worth of Bitcoin to be insured by them. And the cost is significant. It varies from 0.5% to 2% of your Bitcoin value per year. They also offer an inheritance protocol to their customers to assist your beneficiaries after you die. The second topic I want to cover is a Bitcoin-denominated life insurance policy. So far, I've only found one. It's an interesting product that may be worth investigating for a number of people. Personally, I will wait until there's more competition in the field to help drive innovation and bring down some pricing. But I found it interesting, and you might too. The company is called Meanwhile, and they're based in Bermuda, so the website is meanwhile.bm. Premiums and death benefits are handled entirely in Bitcoin. It's a whole life policy. You pay premiums in Bitcoin, generally in 10 annual installments. Since these are premiums paid, they take the Bitcoin and invest it, hold it, spend it as they like. Your policy accrues cash value as you add more Bitcoin to it. You can then tap into that value by taking out a loan, just like any other whole life policy. Since Meanwhile has your policy with the full value, they have the collateral. And there's no margin call risk since everything is Bitcoin denominated. When the insured dies, they pay out the appropriate amount of Bitcoin to the beneficiaries. The big advantage is instead of a policy paying out a fixed amount of dollars, it pays out a fixed amount of Bitcoin. If you ever looked at any of the charts that show how many Bitcoins it takes to buy the average house in the U.S., you'll see that the price in Bitcoin terms has dropped now to under 4 Bitcoin. If you want your family to be able to pay off a house when you die, perhaps leaving them 10 Bitcoin instead of $1 million policy might be a better idea. Looking at their website, a 25-year-old non-smoker can get over 10 Bitcoin payout at time of death for a premium of 0.5, just a half a Bitcoin per year for 10 years. Please note, I'm not recommending these companies. While I've met with some of the AnchorWatch team at Bitcoin conferences, I have not done business with them personally and can't vouch for them. Meanwhile, is based in Bermuda, and that for me adds a little bit of additional concern, and I've had no contact with them. I discussed this today so that William and all the other listeners out there can get an idea of products that are coming to the Bitcoin space. As I said earlier, I'm waiting for more competitors and options before I purchase anything like this. This has been Jesse Markowitz with yourpersonalbitcoinassistant.com. Please let me know if there's any assistance I can provide you with Bitcoin, personal servers, or other tech questions.
Here, I personally think that most people are better off creating multiple copies of their seed phrase in a way where it cannot be destroyed. If you're worried about somebody getting their hands on it, then you basically can do your own version of a multi-sig by creating multiple copies of 50% of your seed phrase. So you have seed phrase the first, seed phrase the second, and you can even have some way of making sure you know which one's first, or the person that you make them available to, if you, in the event of your death, knows which one goes first, and somebody that found them wouldn't even really know what order they go in or what they are. Okay, and having more than one copy in more than one very safe location. And then having people, maybe you even have people that you trust that you give part of it to as part of your estate planning. I'm not exactly sure how, this is something everybody has to do for themselves. But to me, having multiple seed phrases is insurance. As long as you have the seed phrase, you can restore a wallet. And that to me makes more sense than paying somebody for an insurance product that, I'll just put it this way. This hasn't been tested yet as an insurance product. And insurance companies are notorious for figuring out how to not pay claims. Not break the law, not breach the contract, to figure out underneath the law how to avoid paying a claim. Right? How to stand under the law and under their own contract and find a way to not pay you. And you have to decide for yourself, but this isn't, I would tell you this, I'd rather see you invest your money in concealed carry insurance like we talked about yesterday than in insuring your Bitcoin. This way, anyway. All right, let us move on. We have one more before my segment. This is going to be Ryan Steva talking about solar generators.
Hey, everyone. This is Ryan Steva from thehomesteadconsultant.com. Today, I've got a question from Craig, who is asking about solar generators. He wants to be able to run lights, fans, a fridge, maybe an air conditioner. He needs it to be mobile so that he can take it with him, so he's not at risk of having it stolen when he's not there. He needs it to be expandable, which is part of what I'm going to cover today, and he needs to be able to charge it with solar. So he initially asked me about the Bluity AC500 with a B300K battery. And that unit does some pretty cool things, but there are some definite pros and cons that come with it. So the pros are that it has a high wattage output from the inverter. It's got a decent solar input availability, and it's expandable. Those are all great things, but there's some pretty major cons that would make me not recommend this unit. The first is that it's the most expensive of the units that I'm going to show, and I think you can get a much more capable unit for a lot less. Another is that it requires multiple components. So the inverter and batteries are separate, and you have to carry them separately, connect them separately. Whereas the other units that I'm going to recommend today have batteries built into them, but can also have batteries, additional batteries connected for expansion. The other issue, two more issues with the Bluity system, is that it is reported to just stop working, or basically to die. This has been reported by multiple well-respected YouTubers in the solar space, and I would not recommend it just based off of that. It's also limited to basically the 5,000 watts of output. Because of the way it's constructed, it's very difficult to connect two of these together. And so its output, its AC output, is essentially limited to that 5,000 watts of inverter output. So in place of that, the first unit that I'm going to recommend is the Opus Mega 2. This is a 2,500 watt output, which is less than the Bluity, actually about half of the Bluity. But for most of the things that Craig is wanting to run, this should actually run them just fine. And it's got double the watt hour output. So the Bluity has a watt hour output of 2,764, whereas this one, it's a little less than double, but it's 4,096 watt hours of battery life. But the batteries themselves are actually quite inexpensive. They're about $850 for an additional 2,100 watt hours of use. So you can put quite a few additional batteries onto this system and still be way under the cost of the Bluity system. The Opus Mega 2 also has a good solar input, which I believe is up to 150 volts with, I think, 15 amps of input, which should keep you running, especially if you max out that input from your solar panels. The con really is that you can't increase your voltage or your wattage output from the inverter. So you're pretty much stuck at 2,500 watts from this system, no matter how many batteries you put on it. And personally, I think that's about the only con. And in most cases, 2,500 watts for this type of a setup, like an off-grid cabin like this, will actually run most of what you need to run. All right, my second recommended solar generator is actually going to be the EcoFlow Delta Pro 3. Not only is this highly expandable, it comes with almost double the watt-hour output of the Bluity right off the bat. It costs $100 less, and it also can output at 240 volts split phase. So it has all these benefits that the Bluity doesn't. It's also one package and is on wheels, so you can move it quite easily. So I would highly recommend this over the Bluity system. My only real con with this system is that the solar input it's bifurcated into two inputs in kind of a weird way, with a low voltage input and a high voltage input. And to maximize your solar input, you have to make two arrays. And so that's a little bit convoluted. But otherwise, if you're looking for all of the benefits of the Bluity system plus additional battery watt hours and additional voltage options, this would be the system you would want to buy. Now, I'd be remiss if I didn't talk about using a do-it-yourself system. So Signature Solar has a really great 3,000-watt inverter, as well as a really great LiFePO4 battery that you can put together. Some people have even put them together in a hand truck system so they can make them mobile. But the really cool things about the do-it-yourself is not only is it less expensive for more power overall, it is, for your purposes here, nearly infinitely expandable. If you want another battery, you bolt on another battery. If you want more wattage output, if you want 6,000 watts instead of 3,000 watts of output, you bolt on another inverter. And it's capable of a much higher PV input or solar input. So it's a much better system, but the cons of this really are that it's less mobile and it takes some technical know-how to put it together. That being said, there are full videos on the installation and setup of one of these systems. I've done one, as well as other people have done ones, where it's the entire setup of the mobile cart system where you can put it on a hand truck and move it mobile, pretty much like the EcoFlow system. You may also want to consider getting a generator. I would recommend a small kind of suitcase inverter generator just to be able to top batteries off if you needed to. It's going to be quiet, it's going to be inexpensive, and it's going to be easy to move and efficient. As far as air conditioners, you want to use specifically a very small inverter generator window unit, and I've got a specific one that I like because it doesn't have a high startup amperage and it runs at a fairly low wattage. I'm going to give Jack two links. One is going to be for a video that I did. So while I was doing this talking part, I was putting up pictures on the screen so you could see all the things I was talking about. And then two, I'm going to actually create a special page on my website with all the links of the different things that I was talking about. So if you want to go and look at them online or purchase them, you'll have an easy one-stop location to do that from.
Good stuff there, and the links that he mentioned I have in the show notes. I will just say I despise the term solar generator. I think the application that the person's asking about is perfect for a mobile solar recharge battery bank, which is what they really are. And I get why people use the term solar generator. I hate the term solar generator because the companies that make this stuff, their marketing bullshit is far worse than the products that John Pugliano talked about. And they like to do things like, we have a 4,000 watt output inverter. It doesn't matter how many watts you can put out. It matters how much power you can actually generate and store and create on demand. And so I would tell you my personal belief is that putting together a backup solar portable product is really easy to do. And it's hard for me to come up with a way that you get ahead by buying a prepackaged solution, because it's not like building a house. It's actually really easy to do. There's tons of off-the-shelf stuff. If you build it, it's actually really easy to expand. And generally speaking, when I've run numbers, you can produce about twice the system for the same money by buying components, putting them together in something that's mobile. But I get the mobile component in this application. Then one thing to remember, too, is that the significantly heavy part of these systems is always the batteries. If you're going to be using the system really only when you go to a place like this, it might actually make sense to install the battery bank permanently and bring the system in as the charger. And I would tell you, in anything like this, I would have a small-scale generator to go with it. Because that is your flick your Bic, right? Like, that's like, yeah, I carry a ferrocium rod when I go in the bush, but I also carry a Bic lighter. I'm just saying, right? All right, anyway, let's talk about my subject today. My subject comes from Robert. Robert says, the CRIT method almost seems like developing your own personal AI agent you train for certain subject matter. Do you feel one is better at present? And we learn to take steps to develop our own personalized AI agents. Thanks, Baba. Okay, so here's the deal. The term personal AI agent sounds really complicated. Inside GPT, there's what's known as custom GPTs. And a custom GPT is remarkably easy to create, and a custom GPT is basically installing the context and role and maybe part of the task and then doing it once and using it over and over again. And so I'm coming at this from ChatGPT standpoint. And I'll bet you can do what I did to learn how to do it with probably any of these AI tools, Gemini or whatever, okay, if they have the feature. And I also, since I have kind of the advanced ChatGPT subscription thing with two seats, and my wife has one for the kids, and I have advanced features and all, I don't know how much you have to pay to have this functionality available to you or what limits are placed on it. So keep in mind that as I tell you this. So let's give you I did a whole show on the CRIT method and using the CRIT method for things like being ripped off by car dealerships and contractors. So if you want to know more about the CRIT method than I give you today, go to the website, survivalpodcast.com, put in CRIT, and you'll find an episode called CRIT Before You Commit, and you can listen to that to learn more about it. But it's pretty simple, and I got it from Jeff Woods, who wrote The AI-Driven Leader in a podcast that he did with Robert Breedlove, and it works like this. Context. You tell GPT the context you're coming from. I'm a small business owner. My business makes blue widgets. We sell them to blue widget fans, and we're trying to win over the yellow widget fans or whatever it is, right? And then roll. You are an expert in online commerce and widget technology, right? Like that kind of thing. I'm giving the very abbreviated version. Role. Your role is to help me find five non-obvious opportunities in the widget market that I should know about and don't know right now. Interview is, you know, the interview is you're supposed to ask me five questions one at a time to better understand my situation. And then task is you're to find for me these five non-obvious opportunities for my company. And that can be anything. I mean, that can be literally anything. I built one that I call in my custom GPT my five-star mushroom chef, okay? So I started with the crit method. I did exactly that. I told GPT, you are a world-famous chef. You own multiple multi-star Michelin restaurants in several countries. You're that good. And I gave it a pedigree and a background of being trained in classic French cooking, Asian cooking, and Central and South American cuisine, with specific leanings toward seafoods and meat. But you also are very well known for the appetizers that you put together and the tapas that you put together using mushrooms in your restaurants. And I went on and on and on, right? And then I gave it a bunch of information about me too. Like my skill level as a home cook, my desire being that there's certain things I know I can't do, like, you know, all of this gastric alchemy that they do today with foam whips and shit like that, because the Michelin star chef would take you in that direction, that gastronomy direction. But, like, you know, I have high-end vacuum sealers. I have high-end salamander broiler. Here's all the stuff I have. And then interview me to get a better understanding of what I'm trying to do with these mushroom appetizers. And then your task is give me, you know, recipes. And whenever you give me recipes, for every five recipes, two of them should be completely original creations you came up with just for me. And specifically, you cannot go dragging recipes off recipe.com or something like that and repackaging. These have to be high-end things the high-end way. And it worked perfectly. And that's crit, right? That's on the fly. And then I looked at that and said, you know what? I don't want to have to do that ever again. So I took a transcript of the crit discussion with the mushroom chef. I made it into a PDF, and then I started a new chat with GPT, and I told GPT, I want to create a custom GPT based on this discussion. And it laid out all the descriptory stuff, which was pretty much a repeat of what I said, but it left some things out, and it added some things in. And I fixed it so it actually said what I originally said, plus I left some of the stuff that it added to make it even better. And I said, now walk me through how to take this and make a custom GPT. And it's pretty much, you click a couple buttons, you say create it, you name it, and you cut and paste that into it, and you save it. Now, if I want to use my five-star mushroom chef, I just switch to it, and I can say something like, give me three ideas, I'm doing it right now, ideas for using pink oysters mushrooms. And let's just see what it says. And, okay, here we go. Like, if you, I would like you to understand how powerful this is to go use your AI unit of choice and ask that exact question. Here's what I said. Just, this is the whole thing. Because I built the custom GPT on the crit method. Give me three ideas for using pink oyster mushrooms. That's all I asked for. Charred pink oyster rosettes with anchovy garlic emulsion. Fan cluster seared on high heat flat top until edges char and crisp. Plate over a swipe of anchovy garlic emulsion. Emulsify confit garlic, anchovy, lemon, and egg yolk like a broken aioli. Garnish with fired capers and shaved fennel. Serve with fatty pork or aged beef. You're not going to get that, okay? I'm not going to read the whole description of the other two, but Thai chili lime pink oyster skewers, style tapas or hot appetizer, and smoked pork panko, crusted pink oyster fans, style crispy side or shared starter. That's what I'm getting out of GPT. And, you know, then it says, do you want to take any of these and give you full recipe walkthroughs, preparation, sous vide prep, surf meets earth combos? What else do you want from me is basically what it's asking me right now. So that's the custom GPT feature, and it's super easy. Here's something else really cool about it. And I've been thinking about rolling up a bunch of really cool custom GPTs and adding them to the MSB. If you guys would be interested in that, I'd love to know that. That way somebody else is building them for you. Once you build one, you can basically say share it. It'll give you a link, and you just provide somebody else that link, and they can use yours. So that means you could actually build it and kind of lock it away somewhere, password protect it, and basically sell access to it, which is what some people are doing. I don't want to do that, but I was thinking, like, you know, I've got some other ones. I have one that's built as a source finder. My source finder is when I am looking for source material to go with a claim, instead of me tracking it down anymore, I say, I've heard this claim, even you say it's true, find me sources. The problem is GPT, when you tell it to find sources, will often literally invent the damn things. So I locked it down with the CRIT method and other instructions that not only do you have to find me a source, you have to verify the source explicitly before you report it back to me. Because I was getting links, and I click on the link, and it's a 404 error page. And I'm like, I'm not okay with that. So I have actually quite a few of these custom GPTs that I've built, and I've really built all of them using this CRIT method. And again, if you're like, I don't really understand how to build a custom GPT, I'm telling you, all you have to do is take ChatGPT. I want to build a custom GPT, and here's what I want it to do. It will tell you how. It will literally walk you through it. If you can't do it, you're not listening to the show because you have an IQ under 75. If you literally can, I'm not saying you don't want to do it, you're stupid, or you're not willing to do it, you're stupid. I'm saying if you can't get it done, then you have an IQ sub-retard. I'm sorry, because if you could download and play a podcast, you can follow instructions and cut and paste, right? If you can turn on a computer, you can do this. If you could form a sentence that's coherent, if you could ask a question, then you can do this. It is really, it's not just empowering, it's a time saver. Because once you've built that, so like what I should have done, and maybe I will do this and make this one publicly available to everybody, I should have built one for the mechanical evaluation like I did for Toyota. I didn't build a custom GPT with that. I just used CRIT to get the answers I needed for that one thing. I don't anticipate needing that on a regular basis. And I can always refine, you know, the other thing about GPT, you can always search for your prior chats and find it and just continue that chat, right? So that's another way to do it. But I would say, as far as, it's not really one superior to the other. It's like a custom GPT, you're taking the time to put it into a permanent format for multiple use, and CRIT is on the fly. So I'm not going to, some of the things I'll use CRIT for, context, role, interview, task, right? Some of those things, I'm going to use it once, and I'm not really going to do it again. I'm just trying to improve my results on this one thing. If I look at the results and I really like them, and I think I might ever need that again, then I'll refine it and turn it into a custom GPT. But again, if you guys would be interested in me developing, you know, I'm just not going to do it if nobody cares. It doesn't cost me any money. It costs me time. I'm going to keep making them for myself anyway, but having Tom Adams at the MSB and all, that's another step. But if there's interest, if you'd like access to like my Source Finder and my Mushroom Chef and some of the other ones I'm building, then let me know. And if you're not an MSB member, don't, because you won't get access, Because what I want to start doing is building more and more value into MSB. I feel like that's kind of taken a back seat recently with a bunch of other things. Like I just added a bunch of new discount vendors and all, but I should be doing more for you guys that are MSB members, because MSB is how I pay the bills. Now, on that, as we wrap up today, guys, if you're not an MSB member, become an MSB member. You get your money back, and you support me. I'll leave it at that today. I'm just going to say, you know, there's so many good providers in there. You know, we just added Mushroom Mountain in the last few months. We added Cultivated Mind Mushroom Supplements. We added F3 Defense Systems, right? And we just added Kentucky Rebel Scum Hot Sauce. This is the best hot sauce I've ever had in my life. I swear to God, I'm not making that up. I love hot sauces, but I'm not like a fiend for it. There's something about the way Travis, the guy that does this, is doing it that is, you know, it's fermented, plus it uses bourbon. It's just amazing. He's right out of our community. He built up from absolute nothing into a really solid small-scale business. He got so big he had to go commercial. And now he's like, you know, now I can produce. Like, now I'm not in limited supply anymore. Now I got to really move product to make all this effort and money worth doing. And so it'd be a great idea, if you don't become a member, consider picking up some of this stuff. Again, it's called Kentucky Rebel Scum. The original's really popular and lots of people like it, and I do too. But he has one called Blackberry Skirmish. That is freaking awesome. I like it a little bit better than the original, like regular just hot sauce. But my favorite, again, is this stuff called Hot Sorghum. It's a mix of the original plus a sorghum molasses. And, oh, man, like the other night, I did up some simple, you know, chicken wings. And instead of, like, slathering them, I just drizzled a bit of it over it and then hit them with some toasted sesame seeds. Oh, my God. Give it a shot. Anyway, we should have a Friday flashback for you tomorrow, and then the weekend shall come, and then next week we shall do this all over again. With that, it's been Jack Spierko with another edition of the Survival Podcast, helping you figure out how to live that better life if times get tough or even if they don't. Run you round. They said you should have a house the American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.